Liam is going to be presenting the talk. Liam is a member of the club, Socialist Alternative Club at RMIT. He's also one of the organising figures in the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism, which is a campaign group here in Melbourne, which organises against the far right. We've organised demonstrations against Milo Yiannopoulos, Blair Cottrell, Fraser Anning, maybe, in a way. And it's really great to have Liam here to talk. So please make Liam welcome.
All right. Well, yeah. So the title of my talk is pretty vague. Like, did the Russian Revolution fail? In some ways, like, there were real successes of the revolution. Like, it's the first time ever that democratic institutions of the entire working class of a country took power and became the main political force in any country. There are a huge amount of social progress that was achieved as a result of the revolution. But that wasn't the only aim of the revolution. The ultimate aim of the revolution was to spark a worldwide revolution and establish a socialist society, one where production and all of society was arranged in accordance with human need, not with profit. And in the long term, if you're just here for the answer, like, did the Russian Revolution fail? On that level, unfortunately, the answer is yes. These aims, like the aims of international revolution and a socialist society, these aims were crushed, actually. They were crushed by a brutal civil war, which devastated the economy and ended up making a lot of those democratic institutions basically impossible for them to function. So first they were crushed by a civil war, and then they were crushed and further destroyed by the rise of a counter-revolutionary layer in society, led by Joseph Stalin, but with reached beyond just him as an individual, who consolidated a counter-revolution to get rid of all of the victories and all of the successes that were initially won in 1917. The reason why I think it's important to talk about this seriously and frankly is because the degeneration and ultimate defeat of the Russian working class is used time and time again over the past 100 years. It's basically been a non-stop talking point of the right in our society, of people who want to defend capitalism. It's used by these people to discredit the ideas of revolution and of socialism. Right-wing histories aim to use Stalin to prove that any attempt to get rid of capitalism would inevitably just produce a worse kind of a society, a more authoritarian, more unequal one. If you follow this logic, then all we can really do is accept capitalism as it is. But even excluding the arguments that that the right make in society, it's still important for socialists to understand this history, because we do want to fulfil and win those goals that the Russian working class fought for in 1917. We want to establish a world where workers democratically control society. And if we want to do that, we have to understand the period in history where the working class came closest to this task, and we have to understand why, ultimately, it didn't lead to the sort of society that we would have liked. I think if we seriously examine this history and attempt to understand it, the history of the revolution and the aftermath of the revolution, I think we actually find an affirmation of the need for revolutionary politics, for workers' control, and for socialism. I don't think, when you look through the history, any of the claims made by the right actually add up. So in this talk, I want to bust a few of these right-wing myths and make a case for how socialists should understand the Russian Revolution. One narrative that's really common when people study the Russian Revolution in high school, in right-wing histories, in textbooks, way to understand the Russian Revolution is that in the end, all it ever meant was all that it ever represented was a coup led by the Bolsheviks, who were from the beginning an elite crew of scheming wannabe dictators, people who just wanted to become despots and dictators. This sort of narrative is that a small circle of elite Bolsheviks cynically just manoeuvred their way to gain power after the revolution. And they planned to immiserate the population and establish a dictatorship all along. I think this is a pretty ridiculous claim when you actually go through the history of what the Bolsheviks did. Just to take a few examples. One, they were never a small elite. They were not an elite in any way in 1917. In 1917, by October, the Bolsheviks had over 250,000 members. Vast majority were working class, industrial workers. Many of these workers had been taught to read and write by other members of the Bolshevik Party and other people in the workers' councils. And the reason they were taught to read and write was explicitly so that they were able to participate in decision-making processes. They were able to understand the political debates that happened in the workers' councils and in the party. The Bolsheviks argued for the establishment and strengthening, all throughout 1917. They argued for the strengthening, establishment, and for the power of workers' councils, also called Soviets. They argued for these institutions to take power over both economic and political decisions. And these were not just organs of the Bolshevik Party. They were organizations that included the entirety of the working class, regardless of political affiliation. They were a forum for debates within all sections of the working class, reformists, revolutionaries, and everything in between. And these were the institutions that the Bolsheviks argued to take power and successfully argued for them to take power in October in 1917. Not only did they argue for these democratic institutions to take power, they also called for the widespread dissemination of arms among these councils. So they called for every council to set up militias so that they could defend themselves against counter-revolution and against any attempt to reintroduce unequal class societies. And you got to think, what kind of small group of dictators would want to do any of these things? If your goal is to establish a dictatorship, it's pretty much the stupidest thing you can possibly do to educate millions of workers, teach them how to read and write, how to participate in debates, strengthen their democratic institutions, and arm them so they can defend themselves if anybody tries to take away their power. So I think that is one, hopefully that's one myth busted. The idea that they wanted to establish a dictatorship as well is pretty ridiculous when you look at what they did in the immediate period after the October Revolution. So Sandra, for people who were in the talk before, Sandra went over a little bit of this, but the Bolsheviks didn't just want to establish a one-party rule or one-party dictatorship. They spent the first 6 months in a coalition government with another mostly peasant party called the Socialist Revolutionaries. They were at that stage, the main political force among the Russian peasantry, which were the overwhelming majority of the population. The Bolsheviks never wanted to govern alone. But the SRs, the Socialist Revolutionaries, they ended up leaving the coalition when the Bolsheviks signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. This is 6 months after the seizure of power in October. And the signing of the Brest-Litovsk Treaty put the Bolshevik Party in a pretty difficult decision, because they had to choose, on the one hand, between maintaining a coalition party with a peasant peasant-based organization, or whether or not they wanted to end the war, which was the central demand of the Russian Revolution. So they either keep their coalition government, or they betray the main demand of the revolution, which was for peace. And I think it was right for them to end the war and to sign the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. But that's not all the Soviet government did, the coalition government did. They didn't just end the war. They encouraged the creation of more workers' councils where there previously weren't any throughout the country. They encouraged the strengthening of these and the factory committees. They ratified them in law. They produced statement after statement encouraging workers to self-organize and to defend and deepen the revolution through their own self-organization. And you can read all of this stuff, the declarations of the Soviet government are actually really, really cool and interesting to read, but also very inspiring. Gives a sense of what the actual aim of the revolution was, that it was about expanding democracy, not limiting it. However, this process of democratization was interrupted by the Civil War, the Civil War did start immediately, but it became much more intense, throughout 1918. This civil war was not instigated by revolutionaries. but by reactionaries who were desperate to restore the rule of the Tsarist monarchy. Every step of the way, the remnants of the Tsarist regime and the capitalist class in Russia used violence to try and destroy the institutions of workers' democracy. And in this, they were supported not just by right-wingers in Russia, but by governments all around the world. Pretty much like, you know, all the major capitalist countries sent troops in to Russia after the revolution. Because they knew that if they wanted to avoid revolutions in their own countries and mass upsurges in struggle, they had to crush the Russian Revolution, drown it in blood, and make an example of the Russian working class to send a message to their own workers to say, this is what happens if you try and challenge our rule. One of the first I'm going to talk a little bit about how the Civil War sort of progressed now, just to give people a sense of the barbarity of it. The first serious like offensive and success of the counter-revolutionaries of the White Army was in Finland, where the working class had, you know, seized like power, and, you know, reformists and revolutionaries were, you know, trying to figure out what to do with the revolution. The monarchist White Army in Finland succeeded in, I think it was April, they succeeded in overthrowing this government. Afterwards, they executed 10,000 revolutionary workers, placed over 80,000 in concentration camps, where a further 12,000 perished. The total number of revolutionaries killed during the Finnish Civil War was 30,000, around thereabouts. I mean, it's hard to you know, get a total, the exact details, the exact figure. But 30,000 for that time in Finland was equal to about 1% of the population. So 1 in 100 people, roughly, were killed by the counter-revolution in Finland. In Russia, the civil war, you know, escalated massively from May onwards. And there are a whole bunch of like things that contributed to this. Like there's an army of Czech foreign nationals that you know, rebelled against the Soviet government and took over the Trans-Siberian Railway, let in about 100,000 British and Japanese troops to come in and guard the counter-revolution. And with this support, the monarchist general, General Kolchak, declared himself the supreme leader of Siberia. In the south, the counter-revolution was organized again by a series of former generals of the Tsarist regime, and they were backed up mostly by the German Imperial Army. The Germans first installed a client state in Ukraine in April of 1918, and they formed an alliance with former Tsarist general, General Denikin. And during the Civil War, under Denikin's rule, there was a massive explosion in state-sanctioned anti-Jewish pogroms, where it's estimated that, like some figures put it at 100 to 150,000 Ukrainian Jews were murdered in these pogroms. All in all, 15 different capitalist countries invaded Russia after the revolution. Australia also participated in this, sending a few battalions of troops through Finland into the north, again, to protect the counter-revolutionaries and to back up their control over the north. Basically, wherever the White Army took power, they immediately began an extreme terror campaign against the general population. And it wasn't just the like left-wingers and the workers that talked about this and documented this. Some of the counter-revolutionaries did the same thing. So U.S. General William Graves, who was stationed on the Trans-Siberian Railway, said something honest for once about what was happening while he was protecting the counter-revolutionaries again. So just, this guy's no angel or whatever. But his quote is, white soldiers were roaming the country, killing and robbing the people. And if questions were asked about these brutal murders, the reply was simply that the people murdered were Bolsheviks. And this explanation apparently satisfied the entire world. These were horrible murders committed, but they were not committed by the Bolsheviks, as the world believes. The anti-Bolsheviks killed 100 people in eastern Siberia for every one person killed by the Bolsheviks. So that's not to say that there wasn't violence. It was an extremely violent civil war. Civil wars always are. But it is, to put it in perspective, the magnitude of counter-revolutionary violence dwarfed massively the attempts of workers to defend themselves from these counter-revolutionaries. In such desperate times, and against such a brutal enemy, The Soviet government and the Soviet state had to do things like form a Red Army. They had to restart industrial production to supply this army with material to fight the civil war. The choice was basically to try and hang on to control of Russia by any means necessary or face a historic counter-revolutionary massacre. And while the Red Army did end up winning the war, this victory came at a great cost. So I think it was right for them to, defend the revolution, prevent it from being drowned in blood. But it is important to say that the Civil War took a massive toll on the ability of the Russian working class to continue to organize. So one, there are a few factors to this. Firstly, the economy had been absolutely devastated by the Civil War. And by World War One, actually. But after the Civil War, the economic situation was worse than it had ever been, basically. Industrial production declined astronomically. So, for example, like the production of iron fell to about 3% of pre-war levels. And agricultural production generally, after the Civil War, was at around 10 to 20% of pre-war levels. So this made rebuilding the economy after the Civil War extremely difficult, particularly given that at the same time, a whole bunch of major capitalist countries had sanctions imposed on Russia and were actively still trying to economically sabotage the revolutionaries. But this also led to a crisis in the workers' movement, because the more radical and revolutionary workers, the more militant people, the people who'd been around for longer, were much more likely to be the people who volunteered to join the Red Army to defend the revolution against against the White Army, and to take leading positions in the Civil War and the fight to defend Russia. What this meant was, though, that in every city, pretty much across the country, the most radical workers left the cities to go to the front and to fight, and so it meant that workers' organizations all through the country were deprived of the most active and revolutionary and politically experienced workers. A huge section of the remaining urban population also just ended up leaving the cities to try and find food, because there was a massive famines. The crisis of agricultural production meant that it was almost impossible to get food to the cities for a period of time. So the total working class and just urban population in general declined massively. So by 1922... a lot of the figures have it, the population of the working class in Russia as about two-thirds had declined by two-thirds. So it was a third of what it had been before the Civil War. This meant that basically all of the democratic institutions that were central to organising the revolution in 1917 and coordinating workers' struggle, democratically figuring out how to reorganise society for human need, not just for profit, all of these institutions basically ceased to function. And this meant that, in order to hang on, a lot of production basically had to be run directly through sections of the state. So the remnants of the worker state had to appoint people to manage production. They were forced, unfortunately, to reintroduce hierarchical elements of workplace organisation. Again, I think it's hard to really see any other option for the revolutionaries in this situation. I don't think we should champion these things, but they were unfortunately, I think, the only other option to avoid total counter-revolution. And at any rate, the whole point of the revolution was that it couldn't ever be solved just in Russia alone, and that it needed to spread internationally. So the hope of the Russian revolutionaries was that if we can hold on just one, month longer, one, year longer, then there'll be a revolution in, and there were revolutionary movements in Germany and in Italy that could come and relieve the Russian working class. But in some cases, holding on to power meant doing things that were weren't popular among the peasantry, for instance. So in order to feed the workers in the cities, the Bolsheviks had to requisition grain, take grain stocks from peasants to avoid avoid just mass starvation in the urban centres. And some peasants, particularly the wealthier ones, the ones that had large stockpiles of grain and were trading on black markets, reacted reacted in with resistance, basically, to these measures. There were also, you know, there were moments in the revolution where even like sections of you know, the working class were were critical of the Soviet government. So, for instance, there's an uprising in a naval base in Kronstadt near Petrograd that was, you know, that was repressed ultimately by sailors for the most part. Again, like, these are not things to be championed, but these were decisions made by revolutionaries who were desperate to avoid a total counter-revolution and massacre. It's not to say that there weren't ever excesses or mistakes made by the Bolsheviks, but I think it's fundamentally different, for revolutionaries to try to do these, to protect a revolutionary process and attempt to spread it internationally. That is fundamentally different to what later becomes introduced by Stalin. Okay, well, when we talk about Stalin, I think another common right-wing myth that hopefully I can bust is that maybe the revolutionaries did mean well, but their politics just inevitably led to Stalin. So, you know, Stalin is obviously not the same as Lenin or Trotsky, but his politics are just a continuation of theirs in some way, or a development from them. And sometimes, people who make this argument, like, for the most part, these arguments are made by people who want to defend capitalism, but sometimes even people who are more sympathetic to socialism can make these arguments. And, this is what I thought for a long time before I, you know, read seriously about this sort of history. However, I think when you read actually about what Stalin represented, the social transformation that he introduced in Russia and the politics that he had, you see that it wasn't an outcome of, like, the politics of Bolshevism that produced Stalin, but Stalin was actually a total break from these politics. Stalin and his, you know, allies within the state and within the Bolshevik Party rejected key tenets of Marxism, and I think it's pretty telling that in order to consolidate Stalin's power over, over Russia, he had to murder pretty much every other leading member of the Bolsheviks, the people who led the 1917 revolution. And he had to imprison countless thousands of revolutionaries as well in order to consolidate his power. But it is true that Stalin's rise has to be explained. So how did, like, what was a fairly unremarkable figure in 1917, someone who wasn't that well known when the revolution was actually happening, how does he rise to become a dictator of a country? Partly it's because of the situation that I talked about before. So the revolution faced many setbacks. There were retreats that the Bolsheviks and the workers' councils and the working class in general were forced to make at various points during the Civil War and in the immediate aftermath of it. I think these retreats are, again, like I said, they were a product of a situation that was out of the control of revolutionaries. You can't just click your fingers and make the White Army disappear. However, every time there was a retreat, genuine revolutionaries in Russia, the people who led 1917, so people like Lenin, Trotsky, there are countless others, thousands of others in the party that participated in debates around how the revolution should be defended. The revolutionaries always stressed that these retreats should be understood as retreats. So I'll just quote, for instance, Lenin on this question. So he's talking about the NEP and partly some economic reforms they had to introduce to satisfy the peasant revolts and to try and prevent the peasant revolts from spreading and totally destabilizing the revolution. So he says, to conceal from the people the fact that this is a retreat would be sinking to the level of bourgeois politics and deceiving the people. Frankly explaining how and why we took this step backward and then publicly discussing what means are available for making up for lost time means educating the people and learning from experience. So when these retreats did happen, it was important that, like, the leaders of the Bolsheviks saw and argued that these were not steps towards socialism, but they were retreats. However, particularly in the period after the Civil War, the growing bureaucratization of the state, The fact that, you know, sections of the state had to take on more and more, more and more responsibilities take more and more management roles over production meant that a layer of bureaucrats and cynical careerists ended up becoming a majority within the Russian state. So partly these were people who joined the party or joined the state looking for secure jobs. And at best, they were, less familiar with, revolutionary politics, the principles and tenets of socialism, what it means, how to fight for it, what the strategies are. At best, these people were unfamiliar with these ideas. But at worst, they were just cynical bureaucrats willing to follow whatever order in order to, consolidate power for themselves and, keep jobs within the state. And Stalin more and more came to represent this new layer of bureaucrats as they came to collectively wage a factional struggle within the party. So they argued that state management over production was a step towards socialism. It was an affirmation of socialist ideals. They also rejected the idea of international revolution, crucially. And this is, to be honest, I think one of the most important things, because before 1917, it was absolutely considered orthodoxy. It was considered unthinkable to challenge the idea of the need for international revolution. So Lenin and Trotsky described it as, this is the greatest task of our revolution, to spread it internationally. They said things like, we have never, in 1918, Lenin writes, we have never cherished the hope that we could finish our revolution without the aid of the international proletariat. The final victory of socialism in a single country is, of course, impossible. A revolutionary country will only ever be able to exist for a short period of time as long as it's isolated in a sea of capitalism throughout the world. Governments of capitalist countries are not just going to allow a socialist experiment in radical workers' democracy to flourish. They're going to do everything they can to crush it. And that's indeed what they did in Russia by starving the revolution and destroying the economy. This wasn't just orthodoxy in the Bolsheviks, by the way. Marx and Engels wrote this. This is considered absolutely common sense that socialism is a project of the international working class. But every day the Russian Revolution was isolated, it became weaker, it became more racked by economic crisis and internal crisis and degeneration. And this, in turn, affected the Bolshevik Party. And some of these things were, cynical and manoeuvres to try and, win power within the state and overturn the goals of the revolution. So, after Lenin's death, Stalin led a recruitment drive to the Bolshevik Party. He recruited about 500,000 people to the party who were all basically, again, either ignorant, either less knowledgeable about socialist politics, or they were just total cynical fucks, basically, willing to do whatever Stalin wanted. So all of these people started arguing that we should junk international revolution. We should just fight for socialism in one country. And in order to do that, we should aim to form alliances with various capitalist countries in a long-term way develop our own economy. And we can't call for a revolution in Germany, for instance, if we want to have an alliance with the German ruling class and the German bourgeoisie. So the question of stability and socialism in one country directly, immediately prevented was an obstacle to the spreading of the revolution. By the late 1920s, this faction of bureaucrats led by Stalin was pretty solidly in control of the party and the Russian state. And once they finalized their control over these institutions, they immediately used this power to repress any dissent to their rule. Anyone who disagreed with Stalin was imprisoned or executed or exiled. By the late 1930s, the vast majority of leading Bolsheviks from 1917 had either been executed or assassinated. Stalin then proceeded to order every communist party internationally to immediately cease, class struggle against their rulers, and instead to aim to find allies, more progressive sections of capitalism in all of their countries to ally with, in order to benefit the interests of the Russian state. And this, I think, particularly was one of the worst things that Stalin did, because it basically demobilized and destroyed left-wing revolutionary working-class parties all around the world, and basically meant that destroyed any immediate prospects of an international revolution. All of these actions, I think I've made a, hopefully, I've made a fairly compelling case for why all of these things are a total 100% break from the politics of the Bolsheviks, of Marxism, of socialists, of Trotsky. Before the rise of this new social layer, this new bureaucratic, I would argue, became a new ruling class around Stalin. Before the rise of this new social layer, debates were had freely among the party. There were very fierce debates, angry debates about what the revolution should do, what the workers' movement should do. But they were had out freely in all forums within the party, within the workers' councils, and in general in society. The repression as well as the rejection of things like internationalism and commitment to socialism from below all represented a total break, I think, from genuine revolutionary Marxist politics. Okay, so, well, like I said, I think it's important to understand this history because we have to understand how workers who went, I would argue, further than any other working class in the world in overthrowing their rulers and attempting to establish their own power and control over society, we have to understand how a working class that was able to achieve such impressive victories was defeated. Partly because I think we have to affirm that the victories were great themselves of 1917. So people who weren't in the last session, Sandra mentioned a whole lot of them. Like, I think some of the ones that are really significant and should never be forgotten are the fact that the first ever democratically elected government in Russia was established by workers' councils, by the Soviets. This is the first ever election that women were able to vote in Russia. And women in these elections had full voting rights, whereas in most capitalist countries, they didn't win those until decades later. You look at the first actions, like you read about the declarations that I mentioned before, but like the actual things that the workers' government did in Russia were impressive and inspiring. They immediately proclaimed an end to World War II. They said, we're not going to keep participating in this war. It's just about capitalists trying to divide the world amongst themselves. Workers have nothing to gain from this war. They immediately started a process of redistribution of land to the peasantry in Russia. They ended capital punishment. They declared the eight-hour day when no other government and no other political force in Russia would previously. They abolished all legal privileges given to the former aristocracy. They granted independence to a number of countries like Finland, who said, we want to have our own independent country. They introduced laws for no-fault divorce. They outlawed forms of legal discrimination based on religion and nationality. And they did all these things because the working class is a collective class. And if it comes to power and it reshapes society in its image, it needs to get rid of all forms of oppression. In order to strengthen its own control over society. It needs to found a society totally anew and get rid of all of the fucked up elements of capitalism. So there's a reason why the working class in Russia achieved so much. This is a struggle driven by ordinary people of the working class, and the politics of Marxism, I think, recognize this and attempt to recreate these sorts of revolutionary periods. So the key task for the revolution, though, was not just about building things in Russia, as I said before. The key task was international revolution. Lenin, Trotsky, several other, Marxists and socialists argued this consistently all throughout 1917 and after, during the Civil War. In 1917, it actually wasn't unrealistic to think that there could be an international revolution as well. Like, in 1918... German soldiers mutinied and started a revolution that actually ended World War I totally. Like, that's never taught in high school, that, like, a revolution ended World War I, and it was inspired by the Russian Revolution. In 1919 in Italy, there was, like, a two-year period of struggle, basically, that, drastically shook Italian capitalism. It's called the Biennio Rosso. But, and then, you know, throughout the 1920s, all throughout Europe and all throughout Asia, all throughout the world, there were radical upsurges and struggle that were inspired by the Russian Revolution, by the example that the Russian working class set. The main problem, though, that emerged in all of these revolutions was that in each country, the revolutionaries, were either, had no organization of their own, or they were isolated or too small to, effectively, participate in debates in those revolutions. Russia was the only place where there existed before the revolution a party of thousands of working-class militants that were prepared to intervene into debates that emerged in the Russian Revolution, to argue consistently against any compromise with capitalism, against any capitulation to the warmongers, and to argue consistently for workers' power, democracy, and revolution. That only existed in Russia, a party that was capable of doing that and winning the debates. Everywhere else, the revolutionaries were too small, and they were ultimately repressed. So I think we should actually still take inspiration from what happened in 1917. That's part of the reason why it's worth understanding the long-term degeneration, which happened over decades in Russia of the revolution. We still need to be inspired by the Russian Revolution and by 1917, because the society that I described, that was created by a collective struggle by workers, I think, is a lot more free than Australia is in 2019. I think Russia still shows an example. It shows us that a world organised by workers is actually possible. It's possible, to overthrow the rulers of our, unequal, disgusting, oppressive society. But it also shows us of the need to be organised, and not just in one place, but all around the world, all around, all around the country, all around the world. Because this future society, the socialist society that could have existed, was robbed from us. It was snuffed out by, the civil war, by monarchists, by capitalists from all around the world that wanted to smash a workers' democracy. And then it was destroyed by Stalinist bureaucrats who, wanted to set themselves up as a new ruling class. This means, I think, that the lesson we need to draw from the Russian Revolution is different from the one that we're taught at school and university. I think a lesson we need to draw is not to junk revolution or to junk socialism, but it's that we need to be better organised next time capitalism is challenged, if we have any hope of overthrowing this awful, awful capitalist society.